that we're going to hold our own next year and make sure all the buyers know the date. Aliena said, It will make a big difference to Shiring. You and I are the biggest sellers of wool in the county, and if we both withdraw, the Shiring fair will be less than half its usual size. Francis said, William Hamley will lose money. He'll be as mad as a bull. Philip could not help a shudder of revulsion. A mad bull was just what William was like. So what? Said Aliena. If Maud has given us permission, we can go ahead. There's nothing William can do about it, is there? I hope not, Philip said fervently. I certainly hope not. Chapter 10 Work stopped at noon on St. Augustine's Day. Most of the builders greeted the midday bell with a sigh of relief. They normally worked from sunrise to sunset, 6 days a week, so they needed the rest they got on holy days. However, Jack was too absorbed in his work to hear the bell. He was mesmerized by the challenge of making soft, round shapes out of hard rock. The stone had a will of its own, and if he tried to make it do something it did not want to do, it would fight him, and his chisel would slip or dig in too deeply, spoiling the shapes. But once he had got to know the lump of rock in front of him, he could transform it. The more difficult the task, the more fascinated he was. He was beginning to feel that the decorative carving demanded by Tom was too easy. Zigzags, lozenges, dogtooth, spirals, and plain roll mouldings bored him, and even these leaves were rather stiff and repetitive. He wanted to carve natural-looking foliage, pliable and irregular, and copy the different shapes of real leaves, oak and ash and birch. But Tom would not let him. Most of all, he wanted to carve scenes from stories. Adam and Eve, David and Goliath, and the Day of Judgment, with monsters and devils and naked people. But he did not dare to ask. Eventually, Tom made him stop work. "It's a holiday, lad," he said. "Besides, you're still my apprentice, and I want you to help me clear up. All tools must be locked away before dinner." Jack put away his hammer and chisels, and carefully deposited the stone on which he had been working in Tom's shed. Then he went around the site with Tom. The other apprentices were tidying up and sweeping away the stone chips, sand, lumps of dried mortar and wood shavings that littered the site. Tom picked up his compasses and level, while Jack collected his yardsticks and plumb lines, and they took everything to the shed. In the shed, Tom kept his poles. These were long iron rods, square in cross-section and dead straight, all exactly the same length. They were kept in a special wooden rack which was locked. They were measuring sticks. As they continued around the site, picking up mortarboards and shovels, Jack was thinking about the poles. "How long is a pole?" he asked. Some of the masons heard him and laughed. They often found his questions amusing. Edward Short, a diminutive old mason with leathery skin and a twisted nose, said, "A pole is a pole," and they laughed again. They enjoyed teasing the apprentices, especially if it gave them a chance to show off their superior knowledge. Jack hated to be laughed at for his ignorance, but he put up with it because he was so curious. "I don't understand," he said patiently.
"An inch is an inch, a foot is a foot, and a pole is a pole," said Edward.
A pole was a unit of measurement, then.
"So, how many feet are there in a pole?"
That depends. 18 in Lincoln, 16 in East Anglia."
Tom interrupted to give a sensible answer. "On this site, there are 15 feet to a pole." A middle-aged woman mason said,
"In Paris they don't use the pole at all, just the yardstick."
Tom said to Jack, "The whole plan of the church is based on poles. Fetch me one and I'll show you. It's time you understood these things." He gave Jack a key. Jack went to the shed and took a pole from the rack. It was quite heavy. Tom liked to explain things, and Jack loved to listen. The organization of the building site made an intriguing pattern, like the weaving on a brocade coat, and the more he understood, the more fascinated he became. Tom was standing in the aisle at the open end of the half-built chancel, where the crossing would be. He took the pole and laid it on the ground so that it spanned the aisle. From the outside wall to the middle of the pier of the arcade is a pole. He turned the pole end over end. From there to the middle of the nave is a pole. He turned it over again, and it reached the middle of the opposite pier. The nave is 2 poles wide. He turned it over again, and it reached the wall of the far aisle. The whole church is 4 poles wide.
Yes, said Jack,
and each bay must be a pole long. Tom looked faintly annoyed.
Who told you that?
Nobody. The bays of the aisles are square, so if they're a pole wide, they must be a pole long. And the bays of the nave are the same length as the bays of the aisles, obviously.
Obviously, said Tom.
You should be a philosopher. In his voice was a mixture of pride and irritation. He was pleased that Jack was quick to understand, irritated that the mysteries of masonry should be so easily grasped by a mere boy. Jack was too caught up in the splendid logic of it all to pay attention to Tom's sensitivities. The chancel is 4 poles long, then, he said, and the whole church will be 12 poles when it's finished. He was struck by another thought.
How high will it be?
6 poles high. 3 for the arcade, 1 for the gallery, and 2 for the clerestory.
But what's the point of having everything measured by poles?
Why not build it all higgledy-piggledy like a house? First, because it's cheaper this way. All the arches of the arcade are identical, so we can reuse the falsework arches. The fewer different sizes and shapes of stone we need, the fewer templates I have to make, and so on. Second, it simplifies every aspect of what we're doing, from the original laying out. Everything is based on a pole square, to paint in the walls. It's easier to estimate how much whitewash we'll need. And when things are simple, fewer mistakes are made. The most expensive part of a building is the mistakes. Third, when everything is based on a pole measure, the church just looks right. Proportion is the heart of beauty. Jack nodded, enchanted. The struggle to control an operation as ambitious and intricate as building a cathedral was endlessly fascinating. The notion that the principles of regularity and repetition could both simplify the construction and result in a harmonious building was a seductive idea. But he was not sure whether proportion was the heart of beauty. He had a taste for wild, spreading, disorderly things, high mountains, aged oaks, and Aliena's hair. He ate his dinner ravenously but quickly, then he left the village heading north. It was a warm, early summer day, and he was barefoot. Ever since he and his mother had come to live in Kingsbridge for good, and he had become a worker, he had enjoyed returning to the forest periodically. At first he had spent the time getting rid of surplus energy, running and jumping, climbing trees and shooting ducks with his sling. That was when he was getting used to the new, taller, stronger body he now had. The novelty of that had worn off. Now, when he walked in the forest, he thought about things. Why proportion should be beautiful, how buildings stayed standing, and what it would be like to stroke Aliena's breasts. He had worshipped her from a distance for years. His abiding picture of her was from the first time he had seen her, as she came down the stairs to the hall at Earl's Castle, and he had thought she must be a princess in a story. She had continued to be a remote figure. She talked to Prior Philip and Tom Builder and Malachi the Jew, and the other wealthy and powerful people of Kingsbridge, and Jack never had a reason to address her. He just looked at her, praying in church or riding her palfrey across the bridge or sitting in the sun outside her house. Wearing costly furs in winter and the finest linen in summer, her wild hair framing her beautiful face. Before he went to sleep, he would think about what it would be like to take those clothes off her and see her naked and kiss her soft mouth gently. In the last few weeks he had become dissatisfied and depressed with this hopeless daydreaming. Seeing her from a distance and overhearing her conversations with other people and imagining making love to her were no longer enough. He needed the real thing. There were several girls his own age who might have given him the real thing. Among the apprentices there was much talk about which of the young women in Kingsbridge were randy, and exactly what each of them would let a young man do. Most of them were determined to remain virgins until they were married, according to the teachings of the church. But there were certain things you could do and still remain a virgin, or so the apprentices said. The girls all thought Jack was a little strange. They were probably right, he felt, but one or two of them found his strangeness appealing. One Sunday after church he had struck up a conversation with Edith, the sister of a fellow apprentice,
But when he had talked about how he loved to carve stone, she had started to giggle. The following Sunday he had gone walking in the fields with Anne, the blonde daughter of the tailor. He had not said much to her, but he had kissed her, and then suggested they lie down in a field of green barley. He had kissed her again and touched her breasts, and she had kissed him back enthusiastically, but after a while she had pulled away from him and said, "Who is she?" Jack had been thinking about Aliena at that very moment, and he was thunderstruck. He had tried to brush it aside and kiss her again, but she turned her face away and said, "Whoever she is, she's a lucky girl." They had walked back to Kingsbridge together, and when they separated, Anne had said, "Don't waste time trying to forget her. It's a lost cause. She's the one you want, so you'd better try and get her." She had smiled at him fondly and added, "You've got a nice face. It might not be as difficult as you think." Her kindness made him feel bad, the more so because she was one of the girls the apprentices said were randy, and he had told everyone that he was going to try to feel her up. Now such talk seemed so juvenile that it made him squirm. But if he had told her the name of the woman who was on his mind, Anne might not have been so encouraging. Jack and Aliena were about the most unlikely match conceivable. Aliena was 22 years old, and he was 17. She was the daughter of an earl, and he was a bastard. She was a wealthy wool merchant, and he was a penniless apprentice. Worse still, she was famous for the number of suitors she had rejected. Every presentable young lord in the county, and every prosperous merchant's eldest son had come to Kingsbridge to pay court to her, and all had gone away disappointed. What chance was there for Jack, who had nothing to offer unless it was a nice face? He and Aliena had one thing in common. They liked the forest. They were peculiar in this. Most people preferred the safety of the fields and villages, and stayed away from the forest. But Aliena often walked in the woodlands near Kingsbridge, and there was a particular secluded spot where she liked to stop and sit down. He had seen her there once or twice. She had not seen him. He walked silently, as he had learnt to in childhood, when he had had to find his dinner in the forest. He was heading for her clearing without any idea of what he would do if he found her there. He knew what he would like to do. Lie down beside her and stroke her body. He could talk to her, but what would he say? It was easy to talk to girls of his own age. He had teased Edith, saying, "I don't believe any of the terrible things your brother says about you." And of course she had wanted to know what the terrible things were. With Anne he had been direct. "Would you like to walk in the fields with me this afternoon?" But when he tried to come up with an opening line for Aliena, his mind went blank. He could not help thinking of her as belonging to the older generation. She was so grave and responsible. She had not always been like that, he knew. At 17 she had been quite playful. She had suffered terrible troubles since then. But the playful girl must still be there somewhere inside the solemn woman. For Jack, that made her even more fascinating. He was getting near her spot. The forest was quiet in the heat of the day. He moved silently through the undergrowth. He wanted to see her before she saw him. He was still not sure he had the nerve to approach her. Most of all, he was afraid of putting her off. He had spoken to her on the very first day he returned to Kingsbridge, the Whitsunday that all the volunteers had come to work on the cathedral, and he had said the wrong thing then, with the result that he had hardly talked to her for 4 years. He did not want to make a similar blunder now. A few moments later he peeped around the trunk of a beech tree and saw her. She had picked an extraordinarily pretty place. There was a little waterfall trickling into a deep pool, surrounded by mossy stones. The sun shone on the banks of the pool, but a yard or two back there was shade beneath the beech trees. Aliena sat in the dappled sunlight reading a book. Jack was astonished. A woman? Reading a book? In the open air? The only people who read books were monks, and not many of them read anything except the services. It was an unusual book, too, much smaller than the tomes in the Priory Library, as if it had been made especially for a woman, or for someone who wanted to carry it around. He was so surprised that he forgot to be shy. He pushed his way through the bushes and came out into her clearing, saying, "What are you reading?" She jumped and looked up at him with terror in her eyes. He realized he had frightened her. He felt very clumsy and was afraid he had once again started off on the wrong foot. Her right hand flew to her left sleeve. He recalled that she had once carried a knife in her sleeve. Perhaps she did still. A moment later, she recognized him, and her fear went as quickly as it had come. She looked relieved, and then, to his chagrin, faintly irritated. He felt unwelcome, and he would have liked to turn right around and disappear back into the forest. But that would have made it difficult to speak to her another time, so he stayed and faced her rather unfriendly look and said, "Sorry I frightened you." "You didn't frighten me," she said quickly. He knew that was not true, but he was not going to argue with her. He repeated his initial question. "What are you reading?" She glanced down at the bound volume on her knee, and her expression changed again. Now she looked wistful. "My father got this book on his last trip to Normandy. He brought it home for me. A few days later he was put in jail." Jack edged closer and looked at the open page. "It's in French," he said. "How do you know?" she said in astonishment. "Can you read?" "Yes, but I thought all books were in Latin." "Nearly all, but this is different. It's a poem called The Romance of Alexander." Jack was thinking, "I'm really doing it. I'm talking to her. This is wonderful. But what am I going to say next? How can I keep this going?" He said, "Well, what's it about?" "It's the story of a king called Alexander the Great, and how he conquered wonderful lands in the east where precious stones grow on grapevines and plants can talk." Jack was sufficiently intrigued to forget his anxiety. "How do the plants talk? Do they have mouths?" "It doesn't say." "Do you think the story is true?" She looked at him with interest, and he stared into her beautiful dark eyes. "I don't know," she said. "I always wonder whether stories are true. Most people don't care. They just like the stories." "Except for the priests. They always think the sacred stories are true." "Well, of course, they are true." Jack was as skeptical of the sacred stories as he was of all the others, but his mother, who had taught him skepticism, had also taught him to be discreet, so he did not argue. He was trying not to look at Aliena's bosom, which was just at the edge of his vision. He knew that if he dropped his eyes, she would know what he was looking at. He tried to think of something else to say. "I know a lot of stories," he said. "I know the Song of Roland and the Pilgrimage of William of Orange." "What do you mean you know them?" "I can recite them. Like a jongleur." "What's a jongleur?" "A man who goes around telling stories." That was a new concept to Jack. "I never heard of such a man." "There are lots in France. I used to go overseas with my father when I was a child. I loved the jongleurs." "But what do they do? Just stand on the street and speak?" "It depends. They come into the Lord's Hall on feast days. They perform at markets and fairs. They entertain pilgrims outside churches. Great barons sometimes have their own jongleur." It occurred to Jack that not only was he talking to her, but he was having a conversation he could not have had with any other girl in Kingsbridge. He and Aliena were the only people in the town, apart from his mother, who knew about French romance poems, he was sure. They had an interest in common, and they were discussing it. The thought was so exciting that he lost track of what they were saying, and he felt confused and stupid. Fortunately, she carried on. "Usually the jongleur plays the fiddle while he recites the story. He plays fast and high when there's a battle, slow and sweet when two people are in love, jerky for a funny part." Jack liked that idea, background music to enhance the high points of the story. "I wish I could play the fiddle," he said. "Can you really recite stories?" she said. He could hardly believe she was really interested in him, asking him questions about himself, and her face was even lovelier when it was animated by curiosity. "My mother taught me," he said. "We used to live in the forest, just the two of us. She told me the stories again and again." "But how can you remember them? Some of them take days to tell." "I don't know. It's like knowing your way through the forest. You don't keep the whole forest in your mind, but wherever you are, you know where to go next. Glancing at the text of her book again, he was struck by something. He sat on the grass next to her to look more closely. "The rhymes are different," he said. She was not sure what he meant.
"In what way?"
"They're better. In the Song of Roland, the word sword rhymes with horse, or lost, or with ball. In your book, sword rhymes with hoard, but not with horse. Lord, but not loss. Board, but not ball. It's a completely different way of rhyming. But it's better, much better. I like these rhymes."
"Would you..."
She looked diffident. "Would you tell me some of the Song of Roland?" Jack shifted his position a little so that he could look at her. The intensity of her look, the sparkle of eagerness in her bewitching eyes, gave him a choking feeling. He swallowed hard, then began. "The Lord and King of all France, Charles the Great, has spent 7 long years fighting in Spain. He has conquered the highlands and the plain. Before him not a single fort remains. No town or city wall for him to break, but Saragossa on a high mountain, ruled by King Marsili the Saracen. He serves Muhammad, to Apollo prays, but even there he never will be safe." Jack paused, and Aliena said,
"You know it. You really do. Just like a jongleur."
"You see what I mean about the rhymes, though?"
"Yes, but it's the stories I like anyway," she said.
Her eyes twinkled with delight.
"Tell me some more."
Jack felt as if he would faint with happiness.
"If you like,"
he said weakly. He looked into her eyes and began the second verse. 2. The first game of Midsummer Eve was eating the How Many bread. Like many of the games, it had a hint of superstition about it that made Philip uneasy. However, if he tried to ban every rite that smacked of the old religions, half the people's traditions would be prohibited, and they would probably defy him anyway. So he exercised a discreet tolerance of most things and took a firm line on one or two excesses. The monks had set up tables on the grass at the western end of the priory close. Kitchen hands were already carrying steaming cauldrons across the courtyard. The prior was lord of the manor, so it was his responsibility to provide a feast for his tenants on important holidays. Philip's policy was to be generous with food and mean with drink, so he served weak beer and no wine. Nevertheless, there were 5 or 6 incorrigibles who managed to drink themselves insensible every feast day. The leading citizens of Kingsbridge sat at Philip's table. Tom Builder and his family, the senior master craftsmen, including Tom's elder son, Alfred, and the merchants, including Aliena, but not Malachi the Jew, who would join in the festivities later, after the service. Philip called for silence and said grace. Then he handed the How Many loaf to Tom. As the years went by, Philip valued Tom more and more. There were not many people who said what they meant and did what they said. Tom reacted to surprises, crises, and disasters by calmly weighing up the consequences, assessing the damage, and planning the best response. Philip looked at him fondly. Tom was very different today from the man who had walked into the priory 5 years ago begging for work. Then he had been exhausted, haggard, and so thin that his bones seemed to be on the point of poking through his weather-beaten skin. In the intervening years he had filled out, especially since his woman came back. He was not fat, but there was flesh on his big frame, and the desperate look had long gone from his eyes. He was expensively dressed in a tunic of Lincoln green, and soft leather shoes, and a belt with a silver buckle. Philip had to ask the question that would be answered by the How Many bread. He said, "How many years will it take to finish the cathedral?" Tom took a bite of the bread. It was baked with small, hard seeds, and as Tom spat the seeds into his hand, everyone counted aloud. Sometimes, when this game was played and someone got a big mouthful of seeds, it was found that nobody around the table could count high enough. But there was no danger of that today, with all the merchants and craftsmen present. The answer came to 30. Philip pretended to be dismayed. Tom said, "I should live so long," and everyone laughed. Tom passed the bread to his wife, Ellen. Philip was very wary of this woman.
Like the Empress Maud, she had power over men, a kind of power Philip could not compete with. The day Ellen was thrown out of the priory, she had done an appalling thing, a thing Philip could still hardly bring himself to think about. He had assumed she would never be seen again, but to his horror she had returned, and Tom had begged Philip to forgive her. Cleverly, Tom had argued that if God could forgive her sin, then Philip had no right to refuse. Philip suspected the woman was not very repentant. But Tom had asked on the day the volunteers had come and saved the cathedral, and Philip had found himself granting Tom's wish against all his instincts. They had been married in the parish church, a small wooden building in the village that had been there longer than the priory. Since then Ellen had behaved herself and had not given Philip reason to regret his decision. Nevertheless, she made him uneasy. Tom asked her, "How many men love you?" She took a tiny bite of the bread, which made everyone laugh again. In this game the questions tended to be mildly suggestive. Philip knew that if he had not been present they would have been downright ribald. Ellen counted 3 seeds. Tom pretended to be outraged. "I shall tell you who my 3 lovers are," said Ellen. Philip hoped she was not going to say anything offensive. "The first is Tom, the second is Jack, and the third is Alfred." There was a round of applause for her wit, and the bread went on around the table. Next it was the turn of Tom's daughter, Martha. She was about 12 years old and shy. The bread predicted that she would have 3 husbands, which seemed most unlikely. Martha passed the bread to Jack, and as she did so, Philip saw a light of adoration in her eyes, and realized that she hero-worshipped her stepbrother. Jack intrigued Philip. He had been an ugly child with his carrot-colored hair and pale skin and bulging blue eyes, but now that he was a young man, his features had composed themselves, as it were, and his face was so strikingly attractive that strangers would turn and stare. But in temperament he was as wild as his mother. He had very little discipline, and he had no concept of obedience. As a stonemason's laborer he had been almost useless, for instead of providing a steady stream of mortar and stones, he would try to pile up a whole day's supply, then go off and do something else. He was always disappearing. One day he had decided that none of the stones on the site suited the particular carving he had to do, so without telling anyone, he had gone all the way to the quarry and picked out a stone he liked. He had brought it back on a borrowed pony 2 days later. But people forgave him his transgressions, partly because he was a truly exceptional stone carver, and partly because he was so likable, a trait he definitely had not inherited from his mother, in Philip's opinion. Philip had given some thought to what Jack would do with his life. If he went into the church, he could easily end up a bishop. Martha asked Jack, "How many years before you marry?" Jack took a small bite. Apparently he was keen to wed. Philip wondered if he had anyone in mind. To Jack's evident dismay, he got a mouthful of seeds, and as they were counted his face was a picture of indignation. The total came to 31. "I'll be 48 years old," he protested. They all thought that was hilarious, except for Philip, who worked out the calculation, found it correct, and marveled that Jack had been able to figure it out so fast. Even Milius the Bursar could not do that. Jack was sitting next to Aliena. Philip realized he had seen those 2 together several times this summer. It was probably because they were both so bright. There were not many people in Kingsbridge who could talk to Aliena on her own level, and Jack, for all his ungovernable ways, was more mature than the other apprentices. Still, Philip was intrigued by their friendship, for at their age, 5 years was a big difference. Jack passed the bread to Aliena and asked her the question he had been asked, "How many years until you marry?" Everyone groaned, for it was too easy to ask the same question again. The game was supposed to be an exercise in wit and raillery, but Aliena, who was famous for the number of suitors she had turned down, made them laugh by taking a huge bite of bread, indicating that she did not want to marry. But her ploy was unsuccessful. She spat out only 1 seed. If she was going to marry next year, Philip thought, the groom had not appeared on the scene yet. Of course, he did not believe in the predictive power of the bread. The probability was that she would die an old maid, except that she was not a maiden, according to rumour, for she had been seduced or raped by William Hamley, people said. Aliena passed the bread to her brother Richard, but Philip did not hear what she asked him. He was still thinking about Aliena. Unexpectedly, both Aliena and Philip had failed to sell all their wool this year. The surplus was not great, less than a tenth of Philip's stock, and an even smaller proportion for Aliena, but it was somewhat discouraging. After that, Philip had worried that Aliena would back out of the deal for next year's wool, but she had stuck by her bargain and paid him £107. The big news of the Shiring Fleece Fair had been Philip's announcement that next year Kingsbridge would be holding its own fair. Most people had welcomed the idea, for the rents and tolls charged by William Hamley at the Shiring Fair were extortionate, and Philip was planning to set much lower rates. So far, Earl William had not made his reaction known. By and large, Philip felt that the Priory's prospects were much brighter than they had seemed 6 months ago. He had overcome the problem caused by the closing of the quarry, and defeated William's attempt to shut down his market. Now his Sunday market was thriving again, and paying for expensive stone from a quarry near Marlborough. Throughout the crisis, cathedral building had continued uninterrupted, although it had been a close thing. Philip's only remaining anxiety was that Maud had not yet been crowned. Although she was indisputably in command, and she had been approved by the bishops, her authority rested only on her military might until there was a proper coronation. Stephen's wife still held Kent, and the Commune of London was ambivalent. A single stroke of misfortune or one bad decision could topple her, as the Battle of Lincoln had destroyed Stephen, and then there would be anarchy again. Philip told himself not to be pessimistic. He looked at the people around the table. The game had ended and they were tucking into their dinner. They were honest, good-hearted men and women who worked hard and went to church. God would take care of them. They ate vegetable pottage, baked fish flavoured with pepper and ginger, a variety of ducks, and a custard cleverly coloured with red and green stripes. After dinner they all carried their benches into the unfinished church for the play. The carpenters had made two screens which were placed in the side aisles at the east end, closing the space between the aisle wall and the first pier of the arcade, so that they effectively hid the last bay of each aisle. The monks who would play the parts were already behind those screens, waiting to walk into the middle of the nave to act out the story. The one who would be Saint Adolphus, a beardless novice with an angelic face, was lying on a table at the far end of the nave, draped in a shroud, pretending to be dead and trying not to giggle. Philip had mixed feelings about the play, as he did about the How Many Bread. It could so easily slip into irreverence and vulgarity. But people loved it so much that if he had not permitted it, they would have made their own play outside the church, and free from his supervision it would have become thoroughly bawdy. Besides, the ones who loved it most were the monks who performed it. Dressing up and pretending to be someone else and acting outrageously, even sacrilegiously, seemed to give them some kind of release, probably because they spent the rest of their lives being so solemn. Before the play there was a regular service, which the sacrist kept brief. Philip then gave a short account of the spotless life and miraculous works of St. Adolphus. Then he took his seat in the audience and settled down to watch the performance. From behind the left-hand screen came a large figure dressed in what at first looked like shapeless, colourful garments, and on closer examination turned out to be pieces of brightly coloured cloth wrapped around him and pinned. His face was painted, and he carried a bulging money-bag. This was the rich barbarian. There was a murmur of admiration for his get-up, followed by a ripple of laughter as people recognised the actor beneath the costume. It was fat Brother Bernard, the kitchener, whom they all knew and liked. He paraded up and down several times to let everyone admire him, and rushed at the little children in the front row, causing squeals of fright. Then he crept up to the altar, looking around as if to make sure he was alone, and placed the money-bag behind it. He turned to the audience, leered, and said in a loud voice, "These foolish Christians will fear to steal my silver, for they imagine it is protected by St. Adolphus." Ha! He then retired behind the screen. From the opposite side entered a group of outlaws, dressed in rags, carrying wooden swords and hatchets, their faces smeared with soot and chalk. They stalked around the nave, looking fearsome, until one of them saw the money bag behind the altar. There followed an argument. Should they steal it or not? The good outlaw argued that it would surely bring them bad luck. The bad outlaw said that a dead saint could do them no harm. In the end, they took the money and retired into the corner to count it. The barbarian re-entered, looked everywhere for his money, and flew into a rage. He approached the tomb of Saint Adolphus and cursed the saint for failing to protect his treasure. At that, the saint rose up from his grave. The barbarian shuddered violently with terror. The saint ignored him and approached the outlaws. Dramatically, he struck them down one by one, just by pointing at them. They simulated agonized death throes, rolling around on the ground, twisting their bodies into grotesque shapes and making hideous faces. The saint spared only the good outlaw, who now put the money back behind the altar. With that, the saint turned to the audience and said, "Beware all you who may doubt the power of Saint Adolphus." The audience cheered and clapped. The actors stood in the nave, grinning sheepishly for a while. The purpose of the drama was its moral, of course, but Philip knew that the parts people enjoyed most were the grotesqueries, the rage of the barbarian, and the death throes of the outlaws. When the applause died down, Philip stood up, thanked the actors, and announced that the races would begin shortly in the pasture by the riverside. This was the day that 5-year-old Jonathan discovered he was not, after all, the fastest runner in Kingsbridge. He entered the children's race wearing his specially made monkish robe, and caused howls of laughter when he hitched it up around his waist and ran with his tiny bottom exposed to the world. However, he was competing with older children, and he finished among the last. His expression when he realized he had lost was so shocked and disappointed that Tom felt heartbroken for him and picked him up to console him. The special relationship between Tom and the Priory orphan had grown gradually, and no one in the village had thought to wonder if there was a secret reason for it. Tom spent all day within the Priory Close, where Jonathan ran free, so it was inevitable that they saw a lot of one another. And Tom was at the age when a man's children are too old to be cute, but have not yet given him grandchildren, and he sometimes takes a fond interest in other people's babies. As far as Tom knew, it had never crossed anyone's mind to suspect that he was Jonathan's father. If anything, people suspected that Philip was the boy's real father. That was a much more natural supposition, though Philip would no doubt be horrified to hear it. Jonathan spotted Aaron, the eldest son of Malachi, and wiggled out of Tom's arms to go and play with his friend, the disappointment forgotten. While the apprentices' races were on, Philip came and sat on the grass beside Tom. It was a hot, sunny day, and there was perspiration on Philip's shaved head. Tom's admiration for Philip grew year by year. Looking all around at the young men running their race, the old people dozing in the shade and the children splashing in the river, he reflected that it was Philip who kept all this together. He ruled the village, administering justice, deciding where new houses should be built and settling quarrels. He employed most of the men and many of the women, too, either as building workers or priory servants. And he managed the priory, which was the beating heart of the organism. He fought off predatory barons, negotiated with the monarch, and kept the bishop at bay. All these well-fed people sporting in the sunshine owed their prosperity in some measure to Philip. Tom himself was the prime example. Tom was very conscious of the depth of Philip's clemency in pardoning Ellen. It was quite something for a monk to forgive what she had done. And it meant so much to Tom. When she went away, his joy at building the cathedral had been shadowed by loneliness. Now that she was back, he felt complete. She was still willful, maddening, quarrelsome, and intolerant. But somehow these things were trifling. There was a passion inside her that burned like a candle in a lantern, and it lit up his life. Tom and Philip watched a race in which the boys had to walk on their hands. Jack won it. "That boy is exceptional," Philip said. Not many people can walk that fast on their hands, Tom said. Philip laughed. Indeed, but I wasn't thinking about his acrobatic skill. I know. Jack's cleverness had long been a source of both pleasure and pain to Tom. Jack had a lively curiosity about building, something Alfred had always lacked, and Tom enjoyed teaching Jack the tricks of the trade. But Jack had no sense of tact, and would argue with his elders. It was often better to conceal one's superiority, but Jack had not learned that yet, not even after years of persecution by Alfred. The boy should be educated, Philip went on. Tom frowned. Jack was being educated. He was an apprentice. What do you mean? He should learn to write a good hand and study Latin grammar and read the ancient philosophers. Tom was even more puzzled. To what end? He's going to be a mason. Philip looked him in the eye. Are you sure? He said. He's a boy who doesn't do what he's expected to do. Tom had never considered this. There were youngsters who defied expectations, earls' sons who refused to fight, royal children who entered monasteries, peasants' bastards who became bishops. It was true, Jack was the type. Well, what do you think he will do? He said. It depends on what he learns, Philip said. But I want him for the church. Tom was surprised. Jack seemed such an unlikely clergyman. Tom was also a little wounded in a strange way. He was looking forward to Jack's becoming a master mason, and he would be terribly disappointed if the boy chose another course in life. Philip did not notice Tom's unhappiness. He went on, God needs the best and the brightest young men to work for him. Look at those apprentices, competing to see who can jump the highest. All of them are capable of being carpenters, or masons, or stone-cutters, but how many of them could be a bishop? Only one. Jack. That was true, Tom thought. If Jack had the chance of a career in the church, with a powerful patron in Philip, he should probably take it, for it would lead to much greater wealth and power than he could hope for as a mason. Reluctantly, Tom said, What have you got in mind, exactly? I want Jack to become a novice monk. A monk? It seemed an even more unlikely calling than the priesthood for Jack. The boy chafed at the discipline of a building site. How could he cope with the monastic rule? He would spend most of his time studying, Philip said. He would learn everything our novice master can teach him, and I would give him lessons myself as well. When a boy became a monk, it was normal for the parents to make a generous donation to the monastery. Tom wondered what this proposal would cost. Philip guessed his thoughts. I wouldn't expect you to present a gift to the priory, he said. It will be enough that you give a son to God. What Philip did not know was that Tom had already given one son to the priory, little Jonathan, who was now paddling at the edge of the river with his robe once again hoisted up around his waist. However, Tom knew he should suppress his own feelings in this. Philip's proposal was generous. He obviously wanted Jack badly. The offer was a tremendous opportunity for Jack. A father would give his right arm to be able to set a son on such a career. Tom suffered a twinge of resentment that it was his stepson rather than Alfred who was being given this marvelous chance. The feeling was unworthy, and he suppressed it. He should be glad and encourage Jack, and hope the lad would learn to reconcile himself to the monastic regime. It should be done soon, Philip added, before he falls in love with some girl. Tom nodded. Across the meadow, the women's race was reaching its climax. Tom watched, thinking. After a moment he realized that Ellen was in the lead. Aliena was hard on her heels, but when they got to the finish line, Ellen was still a little ahead. She raised her hands in a victory gesture. Tom pointed at her. It's not me who needs to be persuaded, he said to Philip. It's her. Aliena was surprised to have been beaten by Ellen. Ellen was very young to be the mother of a 17-year-old, but still she had to be at least 10 years older than Aliena. They smiled at one another now as they stood panting and sweating at the finish line. Aliena observed that Ellen had lean, muscular brown legs and a compact figure. All those years of living in the forest had made her tough. Jack came up to congratulate his mother on winning. They were very fond of one another, Aliena could tell. They looked completely different. Ellen was a tanned brunette with deep-set golden brown eyes, and Jack was a redhead with blue eyes. He must be like his father, Aliena thought. Nothing was ever said about Jack's father, Ellen's first husband. Perhaps they were ashamed of him. As she looked at the two of them together, it occurred to Aliena that Jack must remind Ellen of the husband she had lost. That might be why she was so fond of him. Perhaps the son was, as it were, all she had left of a man she had adored. A physical resemblance could be inordinately powerful in that way. Aliena's brother Richard sometimes reminded her of their father, with a look or a gesture, and that was when she felt a surge of affection. Although it did not prevent her from wishing that Richard was more like his father in character. She knew she ought not to be dissatisfied with Richard. He went to war and fought bravely, and that was all that was required of him. But she was dissatisfied a lot these days. She had wealth and security, a home and servants, fine clothes, pretty jewels, and a position of respect in the town. If anyone had asked her, she would have said she was happy. But beneath the surface there was an undercurrent of restlessness. She never lost her enthusiasm for her work, but some mornings she wondered if it mattered what gown she put on and whether she wore jewelry. Nobody cared how she looked, so why should she? Paradoxically, she had become more conscious of her body. As she walked around, she could feel her breasts move. When she went down to the women's beach at the riverside to bathe, she felt embarrassed about how hairy she was. Sitting on her horse, she was aware of the parts of her body that were touching the saddle. It was quite peculiar. It was as if there were a snooper peeking at her all the time, trying to look through her clothes and see her naked. And the snooper was herself. She was invading her own privacy. She lay down on the grass, puffed out. Perspiration ran between her breasts and down the insides of her thighs. Impatiently she turned her mind to a more immediate problem. She had not sold all her wool this year. It was not her fault. Most of the merchants had been left with unsold fleece, and so had Prior Philip. Philip was very calm about the whole thing, but Aliena was anxious. What was she to do with all this wool? She could keep it until next year, of course. But what if she failed to sell it again? She did not know how long it took raw wool to deteriorate. She had a feeling it might dry out, become brittle and difficult to work. If things went badly wrong, she would be unable to support Richard. Being a knight was a very expensive business. The warhorse, which had cost £20, had lost its nerve after the Battle of Lincoln, and was now next to useless. Soon he would want another one. Aliena could afford it, but it made a big dent in her resources. He was embarrassed about being dependent upon her. It was not the usual situation for a knight, and he had hoped to make enough in plunder to support himself. But lately he had been on the losing side. If he was to regain the earldom, Aliena had to continue to prosper. In her worst nightmare, she lost all her money, and the two of them were destitute again, prey to dishonest priests, lecherous noblemen, and bloodthirsty outlaws, and they ended up in the stinking dungeon where she had last seen her father, chained to the wall and dying. To contrast with her nightmare, she had a dream of happiness. In it, she and Richard lived together in the castle, their old home. Richard ruled as wisely as their father had, and Aliena helped him as she had helped father, welcoming important guests and dispensing hospitality, and sitting on his left at the high table for dinner. But lately even that dream had left her discontented. She shook her head to dispel this melancholy mood, and thought about wool again. The simplest way to handle the problem was to do nothing. She could store the surplus wool until next year, and then, if she was unable to sell it, she would take the loss. She could bear it. However, that left the remote danger that the same thing would happen again next year, and this might be the beginning of a downward trend. So she cast about for some other solution. She had already tried to sell the wool to a weaver in Kingsbridge, but he had all he needed. It occurred to her now, looking at the women of Kingsbridge as they recovered from their race, that most of them knew how to make cloth from raw wool. It was a tedious business, but simple. Peasants had been doing it since Adam and Eve. The fleece had to be washed, then combed to take out the tangles, then spun into yarn. The yarn was woven into cloth. Then the loosely woven fabric was felted or fulled to shrink and thicken it into something that could be used to make clothes. The townswomen would probably be willing to do that for a penny a day. But how long would it take, and what price would the finished cloth fetch? She would have to try the scheme out with a small quantity. Then, if it worked, she could get several people doing the job during the long winter evenings. She sat up, quite excited by her new idea. Ellen was lying right next to her. Jack was sitting on the other side of Ellen. He caught Aliena's eye, smiled faintly, and looked away, as if he was a little embarrassed at having been caught looking at her. He was a funny boy, with a head full of ideas. Aliena could remember him as a small, peculiar-looking child, who did not know how babies were conceived. But she had hardly noticed him when he came to live in Kingsbridge, and now he seemed so different, so completely a new person, that it was as if he had sprung up from nowhere, a flower that appears one morning where the previous day there was nothing but bare earth. For a start, he was no longer peculiar-looking. In fact, she thought, regarding him with a faint smile of amusement, the girls probably thought he was terribly handsome. He certainly had a nice smile. She herself paid no attention to his looks, but she was a little intrigued by his astonishing imagination. She had discovered that not only did he know several verse narratives in full, some of them thousands and thousands of lines long, but he could also make them up as he went along, so that she was never sure whether he was remembering or extemporizing. And the stories were not the only surprising thing about him. He was curious about everything and puzzled by things that everyone else took for granted. One day he had asked where all the water in the river came from. "Every hour, thousands and thousands of gallons of water flow past Kingsbridge, night and day, all the year round. It's been going on since before we were born. Since before our parents were born, since before their parents were born. Where does it all come from? Is there a huge lake somewhere that feeds it? That lake must be as big as all England. What if one day it dries up?" He was always saying things like that, some of them less fanciful, and it made Aliena realize that she was starved of intelligent conversation. Most people in Kingsbridge could talk only about agriculture and adultery, neither of which interested her. Prior Philip was different, of course, but he did not often allow himself to indulge in idle talk. He was always busy, dealing with the building site, the monks, or the town. Aliena suspected that Tom Builder was also highly intelligent, but he was a thinker rather than a talker. Jack was the first real friend she had made. He was a marvelous discovery, despite his youth. Indeed, when she was away from Kingsbridge, she had found herself looking forward to returning so that she could talk to him. She wondered where he got his ideas from. That thought had made her notice Ellen. What a strange woman she must be to raise a child in the forest. Aliena had talked to Ellen and found in her a kindred spirit, an independent and self-sufficient woman, somewhat angry at the way life had treated her. Now, on impulse, Aliena said, "Ellen, where did you learn the stories?" "From Jack's father," Ellen said without thinking, and then a guarded look came over her face, and Aliena knew she should not ask any more questions. Another thought occurred to her. "Do you know how to weave?" "Of course," Ellen said. "Doesn't everyone?" "Would you like to do some weaving for money?" "Perhaps. What have you got in mind?" Aliena explained. Ellen was not short of money, of course, but it was Tom who earned it, and Aliena had a suspicion that Ellen might like to make some for herself. The suspicion turned out to be right. "Yes, I'll give that a try," Ellen said. At that moment, Ellen's stepson, Alfred, came along. Like his father, Alfred was something of a giant. Most of his face was concealed behind a bushy beard, but the eyes above it were narrow-set, giving him a cunning look. He could read and write and add up, but despite that he was rather stupid. Nevertheless, he had prospered, and he had his own gang of masons, apprentices, and laborers. Aliena had observed that big men often gained positions of power regardless of their intelligence. As a ganger, Alfred had another advantage, of course. He could always be sure of getting work for his men because his father was the master builder of Kingsbridge Cathedral. He sat on the grass beside her. He had enormous feet, shod in heavy leather boots that were grey with stone dust. She rarely spoke to him. They should have had a lot in common, for they were the only young people among the wealthier class of Kingsbridge, the class that lived in the houses nearest to the priory wall. But Alfred always seemed so dull. After a moment, he spoke. "There ought to be a stone church," he said abruptly. Clearly, the rest of them were supposed to figure out the context of this remark for themselves. Aliena thought for a moment, then said, "Are you talking about the parish church?" "Yes," he said, as if it was obvious. The parish church was now used a good deal, for the cathedral crypt, which the monks were using, was cramped and airless, and the population of Kingsbridge had grown. Yet the parish church was an old wooden building with a thatched roof and a dirt floor. "You're right," Aliena said. "We should have a stone church." Alfred was looking at her expectantly. She wondered what he wanted her to say. Ellen, who was probably used to coaxing sense out of him, said, "What's on your mind, Alfred?" "How do churches get started anyway?" he asked. "I mean, if we want a stone church, what do we do?" Ellen shrugged. "No idea." Aliena frowned. "You could form a parish guild," she suggested. A parish guild was an association of people who held a banquet every now and again, and collected money among themselves, usually to buy candles for the local church, or to help widows and orphans in the neighbourhood. Small villages never had guilds, but Kingsbridge was no longer a village. "How would that do it?" Alfred said. "The members of the guild would pay for the new church," Aliena said. "Then we should start a guild," Alfred said. Aliena wondered if she had misjudged him. He had never struck her as the pious type, but here he was trying to raise money to build a new church. Perhaps he had hidden depths. Then she realized that Alfred was the only building contractor in Kingsbridge, so he was sure to get the job of building the church. He might not be intelligent, but he was shrewd enough. Nevertheless, she still liked his idea. Kingsbridge was becoming a town, and towns always had more than one church. With an alternative to the cathedral, the town would not be so completely dominated by the monastery. At the moment, Philip was the undisputed lord and master here. He was a benevolent tyrant, but she could foresee a time when it might suit the merchants of the town to have an alternative church. Alfred said, "Would you explain about the guild to some of the others?" Aliena had recovered her breath after the race. She was reluctant to exchange the company of Ellen and Jack for that of Alfred, but she was quite enthusiastic about his idea, and anyway, it would have been a little churlish to refuse. "I'd be glad to," she said, and she got up and went with him. The sun was going down. The monks had lit the bonfire and were serving the traditional ale spiced with ginger. Jack wanted to ask his mother a question, now that they were alone, but he was nervous. Then someone started to sing, and he knew she would join in at any moment. So he blurted out, "Was my father a jongleur?" She looked at him. She was surprised, but not cross. "Who taught you that word?" she said. "You've never seen a jongleur." "Aliena. She used to go to France with her father." Mother gazed across the darkling meadow toward the bonfire. "Yes. He was a jongleur. He told me all those poems, just the way I told them to you. And are you now telling them to Aliena?" "Yes." Jack felt a little bashful. "You really love her, don't you?" "Is it so obvious?" She smiled fondly. "Only to me, I think. She's a lot older than you. 5 years. You'll get her, though. You're like your father. He could have any woman he wanted." Jack was embarrassed to talk about Aliena, but thrilled to hear about his father. And he was eager for more. But to his intense annoyance, Tom came up at that moment and sat down with them. He began to speak immediately. "I've been talking to Prior Philip about Jack," he said. His tone was light, but Jack sensed tension underneath and saw trouble coming. Philip says the boy should be educated. Mother's response was predictably indignant.
He is educated, she said. He can read and write English and French. He knows his numbers. He can recite whole bookfuls.